Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I do come to you this evening from Hagerstown, Maryland, a town in western Maryland, 3 miles south of the Mason-Dixon line, for those of you who are geographically challenged. And I want to thank Rita and the committee for inviting, well, actually for allowing Don to invite me. Don is over here in the middle of this group of people. You have to raise your hand, Don, because I want him to know where you are. I think it's very important that you know who's responsible for my being here tonight. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 2.5 hours that we're together, you take that up with Don, because he's the one responsible. Now, if I should happen to say something that you agree with, well, please see me after the meeting, because I could really use those attaboys. I am from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member in good standing of the Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, cleverly named, I would say. Well, we are the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and when our group was started, if you had a town and you got an AA group, you named the AA group after the town. Now, of course, several resentments and several coffee pots later, we now have 15 groups and 50-some meetings. But that's how we grow in AA. I think we all know that. Our group will be celebrating its 65th anniversary in 2 weeks. My mom is 96 years old. She lives at home, and she was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. And I believe that qualifies my mother to know something about alcoholism. Now, when the Al-Anons down in Virginia Beach build that Al-Anon Hall of Fame, my mom's going to be in there. She'll be in the untreated wing, but she'll be in there. I went by to see my mom before coming down here. I went to see her Thursday. And I told her I was going to be away, and I told her where I was going, and she said, You're going to be talking to another one of those AA deals, aren't you? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. She said, you make sure that you tell them that you are not an alcoholic. I think maybe I should start listening to my mom. After all, she's wanting me to listen to her for a long time. I may have overreacted to this whole thing, and might not supposed to be here. I don't know. We're going to try to sift through some of the evidence of my life, and then you can be the judges of whether or not I really do qualify for this fellowship. I'm going to ask you to do me a favor, if you would be so kind, and that is that we suffer from a spiritual malady. And the solution to our malady is spiritual in nature. And if this thing works the way it should work tonight, a spiritual anointing will come upon this group. But it will only do so if you stay put. If you think that maybe in the next hour you might have to go to the bathroom, please go now. Just get up and go now. If you think that you cannot go an hour without a cup of coffee or a glass of water, please go now. Do not go at the end. God attends every one of our meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether we acknowledge it or not, whether we believe it or not, God really doesn't care. God's got a sense of humor, and he likes to come and watch his kids play. And he does whenever we assemble. A meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is proof positive of the existence of a power greater than ourselves. And so I would hope that you would honor my request. I started to drink when I was about 14 years old. My guess is that alcohol did for me exactly what it did for you if you're alcoholic. It changed my entire perception of life. It was like a magic potion. It just changed everything. It allowed me to do things. Once I had enough alcohol on board to feel the effect produced by alcohol, everything changed. And as previously been said here this weekend, when you're 14 years old, you cannot drink every night. You can't drink really every day or every weekend. But you can sure plan on drinking. And you can think about drinking. And you can start getting the money together to go drinking. And then you can go drinking. And I love to drink. Love everything about drinking. And I used to say that really I never suffered any adverse consequences when I was a young person drinking. I mean, I knew immediately why my dad drank. Clearly I knew why he drank, and it was a shame that he couldn't control his drinking like I could. But I loved it. But now, as a result of good sponsorship, I am required to tell you that I spent 5 years in high school. Now, I like to think I spent 5 years in high school because I was interested in having a solid academic foundation before I launched off into the academic world of higher education. But the reality is, it was the drinking. It was the drinking. I graduated high school and I went to the local community college. And one summer, my good friend Bill and I had determined that we were going to take a road trip. We were going to go to California. I quit my job at the drugstore, and we got 12 cases of beer and put them in the back of my car, and we each packed an overnight bag, and we had everything you need for a trip to California. And on the night before we were to leave, Bill's father said he couldn't go. And I was crushed. I mean, I quit my job. I had a pocket full of money from quitting that job. Bill was a stand-up guy. He gave me his half interest in those 12 cases of beer. And I'm not driving to California by myself, so... As many of you know, the easternmost border of Maryland is on the Atlantic Ocean. And we have a resort community there called Ocean City. And so I went down to Ocean City, and I spent 1 month in Ocean City living as a bum. I didn't have a job. I slept in the basement of hotels where I knew guys who were working as bellhops and desk clerks. I ate leftover restaurant food, uneaten crab cake, half a lobster tail, were restaurants where people I knew were waiters and waitresses. I didn't pay anything for room. I didn't pay anything for board. I had the 12 cases of beer and a pocket full of money to buy more beer. And I had a great month in Ocean City. I loved it. It was great. I enjoyed myself so much that I decided that I wanted to work in Ocean City next year. But I am a keen observer of my surroundings, and it became apparent to me that it really didn't matter if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a bellhop or a bartender or waiter or waitress. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted when drinking, over the course of a summer, there was a good chance of getting arrested. And I definitely didn't want to get arrested. But I did observe that there was a group of people in Ocean City working there who drank like I drank, they acted like I acted when drinking, and they were not getting arrested. And these were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. Bert, I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I really can see it or pay any attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer. Now, when I got down to Ocean City and became a police officer, they gave me a boardwalk beat, and within a matter of 7 or 10 days, it became readily apparent that I possess a skill, a talent, if you would, that served me well. And that was, I can spot an underage drinker from about 100 yards away. And I would pick out my target of opportunity, and I would approach him or her, and I would establish that indeed they were underage. And then I would inquire, what do you have in the cooler? And they'd say, well, we got some Coca-Cola. Got a little Tupperware thing of tuna fish. Half a loaf of bread. Well, would you mind opening the cooler? And they'd lift the lid, and they're in a nice, even row Coca-Cola cans. Tupperware thing. Tuna fish, I guess. Half a loaf of bread. And then I would reach way down into the bottom of that cooler. And invariably, I came up with a Budweiser. And if you're that underage drinker, your life as you've known it has just ended. Because you're going to jail. Oh, I know. You think you're going to college. But you're not. You're not going to college. I understand you've been admitted to college. But when they find out you've been in the Ocean City jail, No self-respecting college in this country is going to want to have anything to do with you. Now, maybe you're thinking about going in the military. United States military's got way too many people like you already. They don't need another one. No, sir. The United States military is not going to have anything to do with you when they find out you've been in the Ocean City jail. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call your mom and dad back in Baltimore at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to tell them that you are locked up in the Ocean City jail, and they got to come down and get you out. What's that? You wanted to offer an alternative suggestion? A compromise? Well, what did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer? Well, that's certainly worthy of consideration, but you do understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm taking the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm taking the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that? All right, well, you got to promise me that you are never, ever going to do anything like this again in Ocean City. You promise? Okay, you're free to go. Now, it is difficult to walk a boardwalk beat when you're dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and my sergeant. They would come and collect the coolers as I accumulated them. And then I would meet them at the end of the shift And if I'd gotten any whiskey or wine, I'd give it to the lieutenant and sergeant. And I'd take the coolers and the beer and the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. And I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink that whole summer. I didn't get arrested. My definition of a good summer. So I went back for a second summer. Now, the second summer I was there, they gave me a squad car. Yeah, I know. Yep. Lights and sirens. Expanded my territory. It was one of those big old Ford Crown Victorias. You remember them things? I mean, you can get three bodies or five coolers in the trunk of one of those. Really didn't need my lieutenant and sergeant as I had the previous year, but they maintained a keen interest in my activities, and I would meet them at the end of every shift, and I would give them the whiskey and the wine, and had a great summer that summer, drank every day, didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I didn't get arrested. I'm on a roll. I'm a college kid. I'm finished at the community college now. I'm down at the University of Maryland College Park. I joined a fraternity there at the University of Maryland. It probably won't surprise you to find out it was not an academic fraternity. There was a big question mark about whether or not I was going to actually graduate from the University of Maryland. I think primarily because my blood alcohol content was slightly higher than my grade point average. But I am a college kid, and I don't know what I'm going to do if I happen to graduate. I mean, it's a mystery to me. So I go back to Ocean City for my third summer as a police officer. And what I'm about to tell you changed the entire course of my life. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm on the Ocean Highway. I've got a guy pulled over for drunk driving. He was obviously drunk. I have him out of the car. I'm writing him up. And he says to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county that you are standing in right now." Well, I don't know what a state's attorney is. I've never heard of a state's attorney. I've never seen one before. I got no idea what they do. So I said, "Good for you. Sign the ticket." And there was a guy there who appeared to be sober, and I let him drive, and they went on their way. And I finished my shift, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, I pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department, and there was the chief of police. And he says, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me the entire summer. I'm about to get recognition for a job well done. Long overdue recognition, I might add. And so I go up to his office, and what to my surprise, seated on the couch right inside the door, was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. Chief said, "Give me that ticket book." I gave him the ticket book. He flips it open to the ticket. He gives it to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch takes out a pen, and he writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signs his name. It was at that moment that I decided that I wanted to be a lawyer. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic tickets with a stroke of a pen was going to come in mighty handy. And so I went to law school. Now, I met my wife at the University of Maryland. We became engaged while I was in law school. We got married while I was in law school. And upon graduating law school, we went back to my hometown, Hagerstown, and began to practice law. And I may have been there 6 or 8 weeks when it became apparent to me that the state's attorney's office in Washington County in Hagerstown had a vacancy. They were looking for an assistant state's attorney. And I went right over. Here I am. Answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start? Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. Apparently, some of you experienced this in your own life. It turns out, unbeknownst to me, that I have a perception problem and a hearing problem. I see things that never happened, and I hear things that have never been said. But here's what I thought I heard them say. What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never made an opening statement or a closing argument. You never direct examined or cross-examined a witness. We don't have any time to train you. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard them say. Now, as a result of good sponsorship, I have to report to you that I think they said something like, "The position has been filled." But I heard what I heard, and I know it's not going to surprise anyone here tonight that I'm a very sensitive person. And I don't suffer well. And I was hurt. I was angered. I was upset. I now know that I left there with a resentment. We all know an alcoholic with a resentment can do quite a lot. In Maryland, we elect our prosecutors. You probably do here in Tennessee. I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney. He made me deputy state's attorney. Now, in Maryland, when you get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And they give you a badge case. And that badge case has got a clear glass scene window in it. And you put your driver's license behind that little window. And you put your badge in there. And when they pull you over and they say license and registration, you show them your badge case. And they don't look at that driver's license. They look at that badge. Oh, the badge officer? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. No, sir. I am not upset that you stopped me. No, sir. I understand. You're doing your job. Yes, sir. Well, I may have had 5 or 6. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I don't really have all that far to go. Probably less than a mile. Uh-huh. Sure, I think I can stay on my side of the road. Yeah. Well, I just want you to know, officer, that I very much appreciate the professional courtesy that you're extending to me. And yet, yes, sir, you have a nice night also. Now, some of you may be gaining a little insight into why I've never been arrested. But it'll get better. My boss, the state's attorney, he was going to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he became circuit court judge, I'm going to become state's attorney. Now, I don't know how it is here in Tennessee, but back home in Maryland, from time to time, the local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong, and he screws everything up, and somebody else gets the appointment. And that's what happened in this case. Somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. And I was disappointed for my friend. But I was some kind of upset that I didn't get appointed state's attorney. So one night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, a discussion ensued as to what could be done or should be done with the state senator. He shouldn't be allowed to get away with stuff like that. We needed to find somebody to volunteer to run against him in the next election. So I ran for the state senate. Now, I didn't know that the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee and abandon his wife and children and move to Florida, but he did. And I got elected state senator. Yeah. And in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate. And that license plate says, state senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they see that license plate, they got those overheads going on when they come up behind you, and they see the license plate, they turn the overheads off. And they come up alongside of you, and they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And in that way, you don't have members of Maryland State Police tied up alongside of the highway with members of Maryland General Assembly when they could be out arresting real crooks. That guy that got appointed the circuit court judge, he didn't like the job. And after a couple years, he quit. So I went over to see the governor. Governor, I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney. I'd like you to appoint him circuit court judge. Governor said, Senator, I can't do it. Too much adverse publicity associated with that last judicial appointment up there in Hagerstown. I'm not going to appoint your guy circuit court judge. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. Well, in Maryland, it's a 15-year term, and we only have two in our community that time. Okay. So I became a circuit court judge. Pretty scary, isn't it? Yeah. You thought people had to have qualifications to be circuit court judge. Did I mention that I love to drink? Man, oh, Daisy, I love to drink. I'm drinking all through this. I mean, I'm drinking all through this. I mean, we got a group of people in Annapolis. That's the state capital. I hope your husband's not a politician. Okay. It will get better. Okay. I get distracted. And then I heard it said earlier, I used to drink to forget, and now it's working. Well, my name's Jack, and I'm an alcoholic. I love to drink. God, I love to drink. I was a barroom drinker. I love neon lights. I love the way the light reflects into the back bar mirror and then comes through the different shaped bottles. You know, the square ones, the round ones, the squat ones, the tall, thin ones. I love the liquids in the bottles as the light reflects through the bottles, the ambers, the darks, the yellows, the greens, the clears. I love the glassware of drinking. The little short, old-fashioned glasses, the tall, well, right now they're being put away, but the tall, skinny, frosted Tom Collins glasses. I mean, you can tell there's a change of seasons just on the glassware alone. I love the stemware of the gin martini, the fluted glass of the gin martini. At one time, I had a love affair with the gin martini. I mean, where can you get olives like that except a gin martini? But I have to admit to having had a very bad gin experience, and to this day it is difficult for me to go into a pine forest. I drank top shelf, I drank bottom shelf, I drank imported, I drank domestic. I prefer a twist-off cap, but if all you have has got a cork in it, I'm willing to work with that. But if you came up to me and you shoved a brown paper bag at me and you said, "Here, Judge, take a pull on this," I would not ask you what's in that bag, because you would not offer it to me if it wasn't good. I love the ambiance of drinking. I love sawdust on the floor. I love peanut shells. I love the smell of stale beer and urine. I mean, I loved it all. Now, my beverage of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label and crushed ice with a twist of lemon. That was my beverage of choice. And if I knew that it was going to be important, I want you to know that on April the 7th of 1982, I would have ordered something else than what I have to tell you. Because this was my last drink of beverage alcohol, and I didn't know it was going to be my last drink. As you're about to hear, there is a considerable amount of embarrassment associated with what I'm required to tell you, and a great deal of shame, I might add. I don't tell you this lightly. If I'd ever thought in a million years that it was going to become an issue, and I was going to be asked to come to the Tennessee State AA Convention to talk about it, I would have definitely ordered something else. But I am required to tell you that my last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. You think that's funny? I can tell from the looks on the faces of some of you, you have no idea what Tia Maria is. And let me tell you something, you don't need to know. Believe me, you don't need to know. And if you're here tonight and you're thinking about going back for one more run, don't you dare go back out there for Tia Maria. I don't want you coming to Hagerstown to complain to me about your disappointment following your experience with Tia Maria. As a matter of fact, if you're here tonight not drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous, then stay here. Stay here. There's nothing here that's designed to hurt anybody. Here we get a new way of life. Here we get to live happy, joyous, and free. Out there we die. We die out there. Somebody earlier this weekend has mentioned that sobriety loses its priority. Some people get to come back here, but most people don't. Jails, institutions, and death, that's what's out there for us. If you're here, stay here. The only pain I have ever experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a direct result of my refusal to do what has been asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of it didn't make any sense to me, and I'm going to impress you later with just how smart I really am. Making sense to me. I want to know what the outcome is going to be. And my sponsor would say, just do it, Jack. If you want something you've never had, do something you've never done. We get what we get because we do what we do. You do what you've always done, Jack. You will continue to get what you've always gotten. Well, I need to tell you that my wife is a elementary school teacher, and I guess those elementary school children in Hagerstown are very much like the elementary school children here in Tennessee. Them little kids are just germ encrusted. They got germs all over them. And those germs, they jump off them little kids onto the school teacher. And then the school teacher comes home, and the germs jump off the school teacher onto the school teacher's spouse. And the next day, after my Tia Maria experience, I got up, I had flu. Flu! Them pesky little kids had done it one more time. But we go to work, and we don't miss work. You miss work, somebody might say your drinking is interfering with work, so we go to work. Next day was Good Friday, so the courthouse was closed. I still got flu, and I've developed that lower tract distress that frequently accompanies flu. You know what I mean? And then on Saturday, the flu is moving along, and now I got the upset stomach thing combined with the lower tract distress thing. And if you've got that upset stomach thing combined with the lower tract distress, that will hone your decision-making down to a fine edge. But I didn't know whether to kneel or sit or sit or kneel, and on at least one occasion that weekend, I made the wrong decision. Now, if my wife was here, you could talk to her about that. I'm going to move on. Sunday was Easter. Monday, I was so dehydrated from all that kneeling and sitting that I've been doing over the weekend, they put me in a hospital to hydrate me. And that night, my abdomen became distended, and they did an emergency laparotomy on me, and they opened me up, and they found that my abdomen was full of gangrene, peritonitis. And while they were cleaning that up, my kidneys quit. And my liver was enlarged and out of whack. And my pancreas was digesting itself. And my respiratory system quit. Yeah, that's the way I felt. Yep. It was not looking good for the home team. And I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in Washington County Hospital. And my condition continued to get worse. They got me off the respirator, but that was it. Everything else just kept going south. So they told me they're going to send me to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. And I was encouraged by that because I knew people were going to Johns Hopkins and they lived. And I knew people going to the Hagerstown Hospital and they died. And they told my wife they were sending me to Johns Hopkins to die. That didn't think there was anything to be done for me. She should not plan on me coming back. That she should make arrangements for my funeral. I'm glad they didn't tell me that. I'd have found that discouraging. I spent 2 weeks at Johns Hopkins. They did everything but hang me by my thumbs. My belly button birthday is May the 14th, and on May the 13th, these doctors came in to see me, and I said, before they could say anything, the guys, I said, I can't take it anymore. I just can't take another day of this. You got to give me a day of rest. Tomorrow's my birthday. Please, please, for God's sakes. And he said, well, Judge, that's why we're here. We have presented your case to the Internal Medicine Department. We cannot get a majority vote on what's wrong with you. We don't know of anything else to do. So, yeah, we're going to give you a day of rest tomorrow. So I turned 40 at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, May 14th. May 28th, 2 weeks later, I was discharged from Johns Hopkins Hospital. Kidney function returned. Liver went back to within normal limits. Pancreas stopped digesting itself. When you're in a hospital for 7 weeks like that, they like to have a little chat with you before they send you home. Little thing about the do's and don'ts so you don't come back. But if you got an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to tell you. And they just told me, don't get it again. It's likely to kill you. Now, I mean, I was like 1 footstep away from leaving that doctor's office when this one doctor said to me, he said, Judge, do you drink? Yeah. That's what he asked. Do you drink? What kind of question is that? I'm a lawyer. Well, I'm a judge now, but I used to be a lawyer. And when I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I got to drink with lawyers. I got to drink with other judges. Of course I drink. It's a matter of professional obligation. How much do you drink? Not too much. Why do you ask? Well, there's nothing that tears up the kidneys like alcohol. And we don't know what would happen to you if you drank. And then, of course, there's your liver. And we don't know if you have any permanent damage to your liver yet or not. It's too soon to tell. And then nothing destroys the pancreas like alcohol. And your pancreas is in a very tender condition. And so you got these three very vital organs all impacted by alcohol, and we'd just like you to not drink for a while. How long? A year. A year. Ooh, a year. Well, I have not had a drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. I think I can do that. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. We would like you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I know that there are people in this audience here tonight who have already discerned the injustice that these learned physicians were trying to foist upon me because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. And an argument broke out between these physicians and this knuckleheaded judge as to whether or not I drink next April 7th or next June 1st. And it was determined that I would not drink till next April the 7th. And then if I thought any of the pain and suffering I just endured was in any way associated with alcohol, I would not drink till June the 1st. And with that, I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking, not changing. Not drinking, not changing. Sounds remarkably like don't drink and go to meetings. I sure hope you good folks here in Tennessee don't tell new people don't drink and go to meetings. Because if you do, we do stuff like that. We kill people because they believe us. They believe that all you have to do is don't drink and go to meetings. Yet we have a book. We have a book that tells us that if you take alcohol away from me, I'm going to become restless, irritable, and discontented. And that is a gross understatement in my case. I am more pissed off in the spring-loaded position, I'll have you know. And it's gates of insanity or death for those of us who don't drink and don't change. Don't drink and go to meetings kills people. Don't drink, go to meetings, get a big book, get a home group, get a sponsor, take the steps. That saves lives. We're not here to interfere with your life. We're here to help you get a life. This book, I believe, is a bullshit sifter. And by that I mean, you gather up everything you hear in a meeting, put it right on there. If it's in here, you can count on it. If it's not in here, it's
bullshit.
Thank you very much for a little audience participation. This book is truth for the alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. This book is truth for me, no matter what I think about it. That is the problem with the truth. The truth doesn't care what I think. AA doesn't care what I think. As a matter of fact, you want to scare the hell out of your sponsor, call them up and say, "Hey, sponsor, I've been thinking." My dad, my alcoholic father, on July the 3rd, 1968, walked past a church in Hagerstown. July 3rd, message said, "Don't buy a fifth on the 3rd for the 4th. My dad went to AA that night and he never drank again. He never drank again. And when he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I carry his 15-year chip with my chip. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous for my dad's life. My dad became the person God created him to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholism took everything from my father. Took his 30-year marriage to my mom, took our house, took the respect of his children, myself, my sister, took a business he had spent 25 years building from scratch, took his integrity, took his self-esteem, took everything from him. And then AA gave him back the priceless stuff. And he became the man God created him to be. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life and his sobriety." Two guys in Hagerstown, Ken and Bob, knew my dad, and they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism. Not drinking, not changing. Not drinking, not changing. They came to me and they said, "Jack, we have a book in Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. We thought maybe you'd like to read it, find out about your dad's illness." Hoo-hoo. Clever guy that, Bob. You see, with every passing day, of every passing week, of every passing month, of every passing year, that I don't drink, that is proof positive I'm not alcoholic, because everybody here knows alcoholics drink, I'm not drinking, ergo, not alcoholic. Rest my case. Alcologic, yes. You know, last night Tammy was talking, she mentioned it several times. She said something to the effect about the keen alcoholic mind. Have you ever noticed you don't hear that anywhere except at AA meetings? Alcoholics are the only ones that talk about the keen alcoholic mind. You don't hear Alan and I was talking about it. I read the book. My dad's in here. He deserves to be in here. He was a real alcoholic as described in the 3rd chapter. I was not surprised to find him in this book. However, I was surprised to find things in this book written about me that were published before I was born. Things that I had experienced in my life. I could not deny it. Not everything, but things. There's stuff in here. Things that I have experienced in my life are written in this book. How could they do that? Well, I went to Ken and Bob, and I told them that I was willing to concede that there was a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that it was, I could have maybe contracted a very mild case of alcoholism, caught it just in time. That's all Ken and Bob needed. They started coming to my chambers, my judge's office, every Friday at lunchtime, and they brought their big books and a brown bag lunch, and we would eat our lunch, and we would pray the Serenity Prayer, and we would read from the big book, and they would explain to me the importance of what we had read, and I would explain to them as Jack sees it. And as you might imagine, we had many high-level intellectual discussions about the contents and meaning of the big book. And I pointed out to Ken and Bob, as I think it's important that I point out to you, that while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, I got out of the community college in 2 years with an associate's degree. I graduated University of Maryland with a bachelor's degree in 2 more years. I went over to the University of Maryland Law School, where they gave me a Juris Doctorate with honors, I might add, in 3 years. And Ken said, Jack, there are degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them. Said that in my office. I thought that was a little harsh. I'd never heard that before. Now, I've heard it a lot in AA since I've been here. I just never heard it before that moment. But you see, Ken and Bob knew that I was dying of untreated alcoholism. Not drinking and not changing. Now, they were willing to risk hurting my feelings because they knew my feelings had been hurt before and I'd get over that. They were willing to risk angering me because they knew that I'd been angered before and I'd get over it. But they knew that if something didn't change within me, I was going to die of untreated alcoholism. And that's it. It's over. They knew something that I didn't know. And not only they knew something that I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And they knew further that if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, not knowing what it was that they knew that I didn't know, that fact alone would make me angry, just knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, even though I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. But they knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're consistent and persistent in the delivery of this program, there is an opportunity that someday, sometime, somewhere, I may very well come to know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And when I knew what it was that they didn't know, then it would no longer anger me not knowing what it was that I didn't know when they knew something I didn't know. Because by that point, I would know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And then in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know when you know that you know, and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found that to be the least bit confusing, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. Now, when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions, and there were women involved. She didn't laugh. And when I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. I think that's pretty conclusive evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those six separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six of those separations, and we had no idea. So my wife and I are separated. It's December 22nd, 1989. The courthouse is closed. It's 3 days before Christmas. Ken and Bob and I can't have our big book luncheon, so we just go out to have a celebratory lunch. And we each go our separate ways, and I go back to my apartment. And propped against my apartment door is a Hickory Farms package, something that you only really see at Christmas time. Somebody sent the judge a sausage or a cheese log, maybe a little snack. So I take it into my apartment, and I'm taking messages off the answering machine, and I had plans for that night, and I had plans for the next day, and I had plans for Christmas Eve, and I had plans for Christmas Day, and I had plans for New Year's, and I had plans for well into the following year. I'm trying to figure out how to get the package open, and I see where it's taped shut, and so I'm taking the message off the answer machine. I cut the tape on the package. I lift the lid of the box. Boom! And I got blown back against the wall. About 8 or 10 days before, a federal appellate judge had been killed in Birmingham, Alabama, by a bomb that had been sent to his home. About 5 days before, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a package bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I'd opened a bomb. And I went out in the hallway. There was a fire, and I couldn't put it out. I tried to put it out. I couldn't put it out. So I went out in the hallway, and I hooked the fire alarm. My neighbor came, and he said he had a fire extinguisher. And I went back to an area where there was a phone that I could call 911, and when I went to push the buttons on the phone, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. And guy said, "Police, fire, rescue." I said, "I'd like to have one of each, please." And when I hung up the phone, it felt like somebody was pulling my pants off my hips. And I looked down on the floor, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I was looking at it. And my neighbor came and asked if there was anything he could do, and I said, "Well, if you could get me a towel." And he got me a towel, and I opened my trousers, and I didn't have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been hurt, and I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor, and I could feel life ebbing away. And I was alone, and I was powerless, and I was afraid. It occurred to me that every Friday that Ken and Bob and I got together, we always began our time together with the Serenity Prayer. So I reached for the only tool that I had, and I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing that I couldn't change, and to give me the courage to change what I could, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. And I don't know whether it was the fourth, fifth, or sixth time through that prayer, but I can tell you this. God came. God came, and I experienced a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I have never experienced before in my life. And I knew that if I died on that floor that afternoon, never to see my wife and our three children again, it'd be all right. It'd be okay. And the police, fire, and rescue guys burst through the door of my apartment, and both of my eardrums had been blown out. And I couldn't really hear or communicate with them. And I told them, guys, you just do what you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I was doing. And I went back to the Serenity Prayer, and as soon as I did, that sense of peace and well-being, that knowledge, if I was to die, it would be okay. And they strapped me. They cut all my clothes off, with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. And they strapped me on a gurney, and they took me down 3 flights of steps in our local TV station with Johnny on the spot. And they took a picture of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end of that ambulance. And those red and green socks went around the world on CNN that night, and I went to the hospital for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken. And they let Ken come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And he held my hand, and he prayed for me, and we prayed together. And they sent me up to surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows to stop when passing through flesh, but I can only tell you what they told me, and that is that they removed a rather significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And had my femoral artery been nicked, you'd definitely have a different speaker here tonight. And they took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, seated at the foot of the bed was my sponsor, Bob. And let me say here that it's good to have a sponsor. It's really good to have a sponsor. If you're new and you're here tonight and you don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor. I mean, there are a couple hundred people here tonight who are eminently qualified to be your sponsor. We're not asking you to get married. We're just asking you to get a sponsor. Somebody who's been down the path and can show you the way. And maybe you're here tonight and you've been here a while. Maybe you got some time in the program. Maybe you used to have a sponsor and you and your sponsor have grown apart, or maybe he's passed on or moved away. And maybe you're doing that ism of alcoholism, that old I sponsor myself. You're doing that ism of alcoholism. I don't mean to be unkind or to be rude, but you have an idiot for a sponsor. Got a sponsor. Sponsors see things differently. They have a different take on things. Bob's at the foot of my bed, and he's smiling. I said, Bob, I see you're smiling. What are you smiling about? He said, nothing much. He said, I just think it must be wonderful, Jack, to know that you can't be harmed. I said, harmed, Bob? I said, somebody just tried to kill me. He said, oh, Jack, he said, I know. He said, I understand that box that you opened had 4 pipe bombs in it. He says, 1 pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. 2 pipe bombs, that's a little redundant. 3 pipe bombs, that's around the bend. 4 pipe bombs, Jack, you have made somebody very angry. In point of fact, Jack, man has done his very best to try to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, God saved you for a purpose, Jack. He says, God has work for you to do. I said, really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me to do? He said, I wouldn't be so presumptive, Jack, as to hazard a guess as to what God wants you to do. He says, but I do know this. I know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with me or with Ken. You're going to have to do that four-step inventory, do a fifth step with Ken or with me. You're going to have to make that six-step decision, pray that seven-step prayer, make that eight-step list. Begin making those nine-step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12 and fit yourself to be a maximum service to God and your fellow man. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. I got out of the hospital on Christmas Day. Best Christmas I'd ever had up until that point. The following Christmas in 1990, my wife and I reconciled. And she and I have been together ever since. And last month we celebrated 45 years of marriage. Well, she's been married 45 years. I've had time off for bad behavior. But if she were here, you'd probably want to give her a chip for that. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says that alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is a symptom of my problem. My problem is not alcohol. My problem is thinking. If my problem is alcohol, I had to quit drinking April 7, 1982 and lived happily ever after. It didn't happen for me, and I know it didn't happen for you. I don't know how many times I sat on the edge of my bed saying, man, I think I got a problem with alcohol. I got to cut this stuff out. And I would swear off forever. And that sometimes lasts to noon, and sometimes it lasts to Saturday night. Sometimes it might even last a couple days or a few weeks. Our book says a guy did that for 25 years. I bet that guy's miserable. And then out came his carpet and his carpet slippers and his bottle, and he was institutionalized in 6 months and dead in 4 years. Because once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Alcoholism doesn't care what I think. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't care what I think. Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people who need it. Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people who want it. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who do it. Do it. This is an experiential program. Up until the time I started doing it, it was all theory. And I already told you, I'm a pretty bright guy. You might say, how is that working for you, Jack? I don't recommend getting blown up as a learning experience, but I'll tell you one thing, it'll make you focus. So I began this journey. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous says, my problem is thinking. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. I'm not good at it. I've never have been good at it. I'm not going to be good at it. And I might as well stop trying to do independent thinking. That's why I have a sponsor. I call my sponsor up. He says, what's going on, Jack? And I tell him I'm thinking about this or that. And he'll say something like, well, before he even says anything, the words go out of my mouth, they come around to my ear, and even I see it's idiocy. Never mind. But on those occasions when I got a really good idea, I mean, this one's good, and I tell him about it, and it still makes sense to me, and he'll say, well, did you ever consider... Well, no, I didn't. Well, maybe you'd like to consider that before you do anything. Oh. Oh, well. You know, our book says that our answer is a vital spiritual experience. And our literature says these 12 principles, spiritual in their nature, if practiced as a way of life, will remove the obsession to drink, and that's really good. But it also says it will render the sufferer, and that's me, I'm the sufferer, render the sufferer happily and usefully whole. Our book talks about the bedevilments, and it talks about how we have a solution here for the bedevilments. We have a way of life here. Science says we're not a glum lot. The book says we absolutely insist on enjoying life, that we live happy, joyous, and free. If you're here tonight and you're not happy, joyous, and free, get together with your sponsor. Talk to your sponsor about what you're doing that you shouldn't be doing. Or talk to your sponsor about what you're not doing that you should be doing. This doesn't say you get to be happy, joyous, and free 1 out of 10. This is 10 out of 10 get to be happy, joyous, and free. This thing works 100% of the time if I take the action. I mean, if I don't take the action, it ain't going to work. Duh. Imagine that. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to hear a lot of this, and probably you have too, that a definition of insanity is repeating the same behavior over and over, expecting a different result. Oh, yeah. Even normies say stuff like that. But I've now heard what I consider to be a definition that really resonates with me. And that is, the definition of insanity is joining a 12-step program and not doing the 12 steps. That's crazy. It's just crazy. Boy, the longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, turns out the less I know. I hear something I know. I know this for sure. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. My wife prayed. Our kids prayed. My mom, who does not think I'm an alcoholic, thinks I'm crazy. And she prayed that God would please send somebody to help my son Jack. Somebody prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. And if you're here and you're an alcoholic, you didn't get here on a winning streak. You got here because somebody prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. Maybe your wife or your husband, your mom or your dad, your children, your neighbor, your employer. A lot of somebody's prayed. Now, you may not believe that. You may not like that. And quite frankly, I don't care. And you don't have to discuss it with me after the meeting. The problem with the truth, it's just the truth. And that is the truth. We get here because somebody prays us into these rooms. And if we leave, alcohol will run us back into these rooms. But prayer is what gets us into these rooms. You don't have to believe it. And you don't have to like it. It's just true. Now, here's a fact that we can all get our arms around, and there won't be any argument about this. The people in this room this evening have never been assembled together before in the history of the world. And we will never, ever be assembled together again. And our book says, there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here. Right now. Now, there's somebody in this room who had absolutely no intention of attending this meeting. I don't know who you are, but you know who you are. And you cannot deny that you are here, even though you did not intend to be. There are other people in this room at this moment who have been sent here to hear something. I don't know what you were sent here to hear. And I don't know who you were sent here to hear it for. Maybe you were sent to hear it for yourself. Maybe you were sent to hear it for somebody else. Maybe it's for that new sponsee that's going to be showing up come 1st of October. Or maybe it'll be more like Halloween. But they're coming. They're coming, and we need to be ready. We need to be ready. We fit ourselves to be of maximum service, to God and to our fellow man. All my life I have asked myself, why was I created? All those times I placed myself in harm's way, why did I survive? Why am I alive? And the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, answers that question for me. I'm an alcoholic, and I've been given a gift that only the alcoholics have been given. And that is that one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic can affect the life of that other alcoholic in a way no doctor, no prescription pad, no clergy person, no human being can. And only alcoholics can do that. Only alcoholics can do that. I get to be invited a lot of places, and my sponsor tells me I can either stay home or I can go where I'm invited. But I need to remember that God would not invite me if he didn't intend for me to go. Well, if you put it that way, Ken, I guess I gotta go. Don't want to go. Go anyway. You see, because I wouldn't have a life if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Ann and I, my wife Ann and I, we have three children. They are all adults, self-supporting through their own contributions. All damaged by my alcoholism. One guy drinks, everybody gets sick. But of our three children, the most damaged is our middle child, Robert. Bert, damaged the most. A couple years ago, he got married. A wonderful young lady. He's very successful in his work. They had a little girl, our first grandchild. As happens with young married couples, she became pregnant again. And they were going to have a little boy, and he was born on February the 5th, 2010. Ann and I went to the hospital to be there. In our book it says, if you align yourself with the God of your understanding and you're in proper alignment, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. We arrived at the hospital and they said that we could go back where the mom and the baby were, and we went back and, what have you named your son? And our daughter-in-law said to Bert, you haven't told him. He said, no, I thought we'd tell him together. We've named our son Jack. That boy wouldn't have come across the street with a thimble full of water. My ass would have been on fire when I got here. And that's a great event that has come to pass for us. The healing that has taken place between that boy and me, only God could bring about. Only God has the power to bring that about. Our book says that broken hearts will be mended, relationships will be restored. That's not a theory. That's the experience of everybody who's spoken here this weekend, and I suspect it's the experience of our speaker tomorrow morning. We are blessed. We are blessed. But we are called to do important work. It's an action program. My favorite chapter in the big book is into thinking, but this is an action program. So let's get into action, okay? When we leave here, let's go help somebody. Let's save a life. Let's do what God has called us to do. Let's be grateful, recovered members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me share.